The Vintage Gamer, Episode 29, Interview with Greg Kostikian.
You must be listening to the Goblin Broadcast Network at gbn.com. Amazing!
Hello, and welcome to The Vintage Gamer, the podcast that seeks out great games from an earlier era. I'm your host, Jim Van Wert. Each week, I usually take a look at a game from the past, either a board game, card game, role-playing game, or computer game. And if you like what you hear, you can download more great episodes, or even subscribe, at www.thevintagegamer.net. Well, you might have noticed that while I usually cover a game from the past, this show is going to be a little bit different. And I'll get to that in just a second. But first, let me apologize for the long hiatus. The month of February was spent mostly doing two things. One, trying to find a decent school for our daughter. And two, preparing for the Game Developers Conference. You'd think that number one, looking for a new school, wouldn't be too hard, but the Durham school system is fraught with minefields. That said, she did get into a decent school, so all that work was worth it. And before I get into the Game Developers Conference, let me first cover a few other news items. First of all, I am now a proud member of the Gaming Podcast Network, which means I get to play two identifiers during my show. And many thanks to Mike Stackpole and Kat for letting me join the crew over there, which includes such fine folks as Have Games Will Travel and Pulp Gamer. Secondly, I'd like to apologize to a couple of the Politica contest winners. Again, because I've been so busy, the games have been rattling around in the back of my car, waiting for an opportunity to go out into the mail. Well, I finally got them out on Thursday, and I hope you enjoy them. I also have some other items I've promised to people out there, and you'll get those as well, I promise, if you don't have them already by the time you hear this. Now to the Game Developers Conference. I got back earlier this week and have just recovered. For those who don't know, the annual Game Developers Conference, or just GDC, is a chance for developers of electronic games to get together and discuss the latest techniques and technologies in the industry. This year was probably the busiest GDC I've ever attended. Other than sleep time, there really wasn't a moment where I wasn't in a lecture or talking with someone about games. I was there, ostensibly, to present, with five other people, my usual tutorial on game physics, hence the preparation time. But, again, it was all worth it. It went really well, and I think it was one of the best tutorials we've ever done. But why should you care about my presence at the Game Developers Conference? Well, I also had the opportunity to interview not one, but two luminaries of older games. Tonight is Greg Kostikian's turn. If you're not familiar with the name, he's probably best known as the primary designer on the award-winning RPG Paranoia, as well as the award-winning game The Creature That Ate Sheboygan and the award-winning game Pax Britannica, among many other award-winning games. These days, he is the CEO of Manifesto Games, which is an independent game publisher, and he's also an all-around maverick of the computer games industry, for which he was justly awarded at the most recent GDC. So with that, and not much further ado, we'll get to my interview with Greg Kostikian right after this brief message.
Hi, I'm Paul Tevis from Have Games Will Travel, and this is the Gaming Podcast Network.
It's the grooviest gaming show out there. It's the Groovecast. Join your host, Mark Thayen Reed, and each week's special guest as they explore topics on gaming online. Visit the Groovecast at www.groovygamers.com.
Hi, this is Jim Van Wert of The Vintage Gamer. I'm here with Greg Kostikian. Pronouncing that correctly?
Yes.
Okay.
of many, many game companies and games. We're at the Game Developers Conference 2007, and we're going to talk a little bit about its history.
Okay.
So, welcome to the Vintage Gamer, Greg.
No, thank you.
I guess to start out with... Oh, so you're picking that up pretty well.
Oh, well.
How did you get into the games industry?
Okay, so when I was a teenager living in New York City, there was a board game publisher called SPI in New York, and I was a fan of their games and subscribed to their magazine. And they had open playtests on Friday night in which you could come in and play the games under development, which was good for them because they got, in essence, free playtesting, and good for those of us who are fans of their games because we felt like we got to participate in the development of them. And essentially, I went frequently to Friday night playtests, hung out there, made a nuisance of myself. And at one point, the guys in the back room who assembled and shipped the games tried to unionize. Jim Dunnigan, the president of the company, fired the lot of them and hired I and a bunch of other teenagers to assemble and ship games, in essence. We were not even paid in cash. We were paid in company scrip that we could take up to the front desk in exchange for games,
okay.
Which at the time I thought was an okay deal. Of course, once I had their entire inventory, I started selling the script to other people at 80 cents on the dollar. And at that point, Jim Dunnigan decided maybe he should put us on at minimum wage. So,
so were you playing games? I guess you were playing games before that.
I was playing games before I discovered wargaming, more kind of classic board and card games. But back in those days, this is pre-digital, so the only real games out there were board war games and the older school of mass market board games.
Right. So how did you end up getting into designing for this?
Well, after a while they put me... since they saw what I was doing in playtesting and so forth, they put me on the design staff initially as a kind of a gopher, making copies of maps of games and that kind of thing. But when I was 15, they kind of apprenticed me to Rich Berg, developing a game that he was designing, retyping his rules, making some suggestions, and so on. And later on published my first game, which was a game based on the Battle of Alamein, which is a terrible game and thankfully out of print and never likely to see print again.
That would be Supercharged.
That would be Supercharged, yeah. So that was my only design published before I went to college, although there were a slew of games that I developed before I went to college. And then I continued designing games on a freelance basis throughout college.
Okay. So one of those would be Swords and Sorcery.
Swords and Sorcery, yes, which was developed with Eric Goldberg.
Right. Is that where you met Eric, or is it?
Well, I met Eric at SBI back in that era, and so we were both 14 when we first met.
Okay.
Yeah.
And
I should mention, we've collaborated in a lot of things since then, too.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Which is why I bring it up, because going through the list here, you've worked a lot together.
Mm-hmm. But your list is the board game. So I work with him at Crossover Technologies. I work with him at Unplugged Games. He's an advisor to my current company. So in the in the digital arena too, I've also collaborated with him a lot.
So in 1979, you developed the Creature of the Age Shipbuilder.
Yes.
And that was your first Origins award?
Yes, it was my first Origins award.
You were 19 at the time.
Right.
So how did it feel to be 19 and win the Origins Award?
It felt really good.
I can imagine.
Yeah.
I'm sure there are a lot of people who are grinding their teeth right now thinking about someone that young.
Mm-hmm.
Having that opportunity.
The industry was kind of wide open at that point, as digital games was later. I'm not even sure it would be impossible to do that today, either. A little bit more difficult, but...
Right. Okay, so you worked at West End, or worked for West End, I guess, while you were in college?
No, after college.
And after college? I'm sorry.
Yeah.
I was in SBI.
SBI, yes.
Yes. And so I guess that relationship stopped when TSR bought out SBI?
Actually, there's kind of an amusing story there. In 1982, I was recently graduated from college, And Brad Hessel, who was then head of R&D at SBI, called me in and said, how would you like to be games editor for Ares Magazine? And I said, sounds good to me. And he said, show up for work on Monday. I showed up for work on Monday to discover that some people from TSR had shown up. The sale had already happened, but they showed up that day and they said, no, we're shutting down the office. And anyone who wants to move to Lake Geneva, Wisconsin at a reduced salary, because of course the cost of living is so much lower in Wisconsin, can come with us. It's like, and I and all the other New Yorkers on staff said, you must be out of your minds. But so I was a TSR employee for maybe 15 seconds before. Wow. Yeah.
Am I understanding you have a story about how Luzzaci, is that how you pronounce his name?
Luzzaci?
Luzzaci, yeah. Was cleaning out the warehouse.
Oh, yeah. So the warehouse for SBI was off in Jersey City. Curiously enough, I lived about four blocks away from it some years later and used to drive past it, and they still had the SBI name painted on front of the warehouse. TSR really didn't see value in most of the inventory that was sitting in the warehouse, so they basically just threw it out. Luzzaci, who was a distributor in the industry, learned of this at the time and basically rented a truck, drove it up to New Jersey, and was loading stuff into the back of his truck as fast as he could while TSR was throwing the stuff out. So.
Yeah, the rumor is that he used that to start up his... he was doing that before.
Game Science was around before then, but
right,
yeah.
Right. So. Certainly didn't hurt, I'm sure.
Right, well, free inventory is always good.
So how did you get involved with working with West End Games then?
Okay, so West End Games was founded by a fellow by the name of Daniel Scott Palter. It had been around for several years previously, kind of as a hobby project of his, and published a couple of games from Al Nofi and a couple of other people. And he decided to get more active with it, and basically one of his friends and his girlfriend took offices and started publishing a series of games. I was then doing freelance game design for a number of different companies and showed a game to them, which was Bug-Eyed Monsters, and they seemed to like it. So I then did a couple of other games for them on a freelance basis, and eventually they said, well, would you like to come work for us full time? And I said, sure.
Okay. Yeah. So I'm curious why, and just looking at the history of it, was Toon was published through Steve Jackson Games.
That's right.
Through West End.
Right.
Was that because West End was not publishing RPGs at that time?
Well, that was before I started working for West End full time. So I was doing games for Victory Games, for Steve Jackson, for West End, maybe for some other people during the period. And Steve Jackson seemed like the right place to submit that game. And actually, it was originally done as an article, a much shorter piece as an article for a Space Gamer. And it kind of sat in their archives for some months until Warren Spector went to work for Steve Jackson, pulled it out, and Warren is a serious Warner Brothers Animation fan, and he loved this, and said, you know, we should expand this into a full product. And so, you know, at least half of what's in that game is his work.
Okay. But, and then came Paranoia.
Mm-hmm.
My understanding is that the seed for that came from Daniel Gelber?
Yeah. Dan Gelber is a New York area games master and an old friend of mine. And he ran this game for me at his house. And I said, you know, this is a really cool background and a really cool idea, and why don't you let me try to turn it into a commercial product? And he said yes. And this was when I was still a freelancer before I'd gone to work for West End. I submitted it to, I don't know, half dozen publishers, none of whom wanted it. And then when I started working for West End, it wasn't actually me, it was Eric Goldberg, said, remember that game Paranoia? What, you know, why don't we do something with that? So I pulled it out of the closet, and at that point it was still quite rough. The game that was published was very different from that manuscript, but yeah.
Right. My understanding is the first edition is a little darker than the second edition, which is a little lighter.
Well, I think when we were... We hadn't quite gotten the nature of the humor down with the first edition. And once we saw what people were responding to, we said, well, you know, the system itself is a little bit too complicated maybe for what it needs to be doing, and we really need to pump up the humorous aspect of the game. So I think the second edition is actually much more successful as a game than the first.
you had nothing to do with the XP edition.
Well, wait, I had nothing to do with the so-called fifth edition, which was the third edition.
Yeah.
No, in 1985 or thereabouts, I and Eric had a falling out with Dan Poulter, the owner of West End, and we left under fairly uncomfortable circumstances. And a few years later, as is typical in the role-playing games industry, they wanted to revise sales of the game by doing a revised edition. And so prepared this new edition of the game, which I think was something of an abortion. I never liked the approach they took to it. It seems that Paranoia fans in general agree with me. So,
Very, very diplomatic.
Yeah.
I'm sorry. So the XP edition is the new one with
right.
Alan Varney has been working.
Yes. Yes. So some years ago, so when West End went bankrupt, our contract called for rights to revert to us. And one of the advantages I had was my dad is a lawyer with a major New York law firm. And Dan Gilbert didn't really want to get into a legal fight that would be very costly and cost me nothing since I got free legal advice from my dad's law firm.
Yes.
So we managed to get the bankruptcy court to revert rights to us. And we, you know, Eric and I both are busy people and we didn't really do anything with it for years. But I guess back around 2001, we decided maybe we should try to do something with it. Started talking to a bunch of different publishers about publishing it, made a deal with Mongoose to do it. But since neither Eric nor I really had time to work on a new edition, we wanted at least to ensure that whoever did do the new edition was someone we had complete confidence in. And we gave Mongoose a list of about six people who were absolutely pre-approved. And if they wanted to propose someone else, we'd look at his work and so forth. Alan was available at the time. And, of course, Eric and I both have the highest regard for Alan's talents. So that was a happy medium.
Yes. I'll just ask it anyway. I assume you're happy with that.
Yeah, sure. Absolutely. I wish we had more time to work on it. There's a lot of stuff in terms of kind of integrating modern technology into the Paranoia universe that I'd love to do. We did a little bit of that with mobile technology and so on. But so,
are you willing to talk about at all about the falling out with West End? And I guess that was.
I'm sure. I mean, it's kind of ancient history at this point. So when Eric went to work for West End, he had kind of made a verbal deal with Dan that if we reached certain sales objectives, Eric and I would get equity in the company. After the Star Wars license was acquired by Eric and us, we negotiated the deal with Lucasfilms, and at that point, West End had basically increased by a factor of 10 its sales from the time when we went to work for the company. Eric started pressuring Dan and saying, let's get this done. And Dan's response was, well, just get the Star Wars out and then we'll talk about it. So we completed Star Wars. We went out to his offices in Long Island and, for this discussion about, what was going to happen. And Dan basically said, well, I'm not prepared to go ahead on that basis. Let's talk about your severance. It was like, okay. So, we learned a valuable lesson from that, which is get it in writing.
very, very good advice for anybody.
Yes.
So, I guess after that, you guys formed Crossover Technology?
Not for some years. The immediate thing after that is we made a complicated three-way deal with Lucasfilm and St. Martin's Press to do games based on Willow. The forthcoming Lucas movie. This, of course, was before it came out and was a disaster. So at the time, it was thought, well, maybe Lucas is going to do for fantasy what he did for science fiction with Star Wars. The game actually sold reasonably well. It sold about 25,000 copies, which would have been fine, except that St. Martin's Press had gotten really excited about it and printed 75,000 copies.
Oh, dear.
Most of which wound up on a slow boat to Argentina, I understand. Eric, shortly after that, founded Crossover Technologies. At that point, I was a house husband, living at home, taking care of my kids, doing some writing, and also doing some work for Prodigy.
So Mad Maze was directly for Prodigy. It wasn't through Crossover.
No. Yes, Mad Maze was directly to Prodigy. Actually, the original version of Mad Maze had been done something like 7 or 8 years earlier by Eric for Trintex, which was a market test for a videotext system jointly sponsored by CBS, IBM, and Sears, if I recall correctly. And, you know, this was a very short-lived venture, and they only had like 2,000 homes in the test, but it was the single most successful feature on that thing at the time. And Prodigy was a successor to Trintex, and so the guy who was running games for Prodigy said, why don't we update and redo Mad Maze? Yeah.
I remember those small online ventures that popped up around that time. My parents signed up for one through the cable company.
Uh-huh, yep.
Let's see. So let's go back to SPI briefly.
Mm-hmm.
In 96, you wrote an article about how war games are essentially dead and TSR didn't
work. Right.
I was wondering, that was 10 years ago.
Mm-hmm. So,
mm-hmm. I was wondering if you still feel that way.
Well, I mean, they haven't died entirely. There is a small fan market for board war games. It's not anything like it was in the glory days, but it's nice that it still continues.
I was wondering how you felt about the stuff that's being published by like Multiman Press and GMT. Whether you're keeping up with any of that.
Oh, I don't. I have to admit, I don't really keep up with the modern board war game market. I mean, I'm aware of the way. Actually, Multiman Press is doing a new edition of Swords and Sorcery sometime next year. So.
Mm-hmm. Do you ever miss working in the paper game industry?
Sure. I mean, one of the frustrations of dealing with digital games is just the lengthy development time. I remember working on Evolution. It was like 9 months from project inception before we had anything that you could actually play. It's much more congenial to be able to spend a couple of weeks working on something and play it and spend most of the development process iteratively refining it, rather than realizing this sucks and desperately trying to rescue it in the remaining time before the publisher forces you to go gold. I don't miss poverty.
Right. that's a common reaction for a lot of people who have left paper gaming.
Yeah.
So from that, I mean, you're working for Nokia.
Right.
And Holdfield, Unplugged, that started in 2000.
Yes.
Is that sort of a continuation or crossover? Or is it?
Well, okay, so although I retained an office at Crossover, I had left the company a couple of years previously because they went through one of these cycles, as is very typical for computer game developers, where one project ended, they didn't have funding for the next one, they had to lay a bunch of people off. So I was doing a lot of consulting for various companies and had a gig with a German management consultancy called Rollenberger and Partner advising British Telecom on the games portion of their wireless data strategy, which is the first time I kind of became aware of evolutions in mobile technology that made it possible to do some sort of games on mobile devices. And of course, this was the dot-com era, and venture capital seemed to be easy to come by, so I decided to put together a business plan and try to found a company to do mobile games. At the same time, Crossover was kind of going nowhere, and Eric was looking for another direction for his company. So he said, well, let's join forces, and you get a development team and offices and, you know, a lot of infrastructure off the bat. So that, you know, I said, fine.
Okay.
Yeah.
Then you joined Nokia in 2000.
Well, okay, so Unplugged went out of business shortly after 9/11, when we were on, you know, it's essentially before 9/11, we were trying to put together a serious venture round, which would have kept us going for several years thereafter. After 9/11, no one in the Northeast was doing any kind of VC investment. Our staff had already gone for 3 months without salary and the expectation of closing a VC round, and we said, all right, well, we will throw in the towel. Now, I'll also mention that Unplugged was founded at about the same time with a very similar business plan to Jamdat, a company which did close on a serious VC round and went public 2 years ago with a market capitalization of over $600 million.
I'm not.
And, you know, I know the guys from Jamdat and they're good people, and, you know, it's okay. But so after that, I went to work for Nokia for some time. Originally, editing the games portion of their developer web support website, and then working for them as a games researcher.
Which I guess leads us to Manifesto.
Right.
Which is what you're doing now.
Yes.
It seems that the beginning of Manifesto began 2 years ago here at GDC with a rather rant, but I guess there's some...
Yeah, it goes back a little farther than that. So in 1999, I wrote an article for Game Developer magazine essentially saying that the industry needs an indie label, needs the equivalent of what independent music and independent film provide for their industries, a way for people to experiment at lower budgets with more creative and offbeat product.
Right.
And for years I've been thinking, you know, about how to try to do that and didn't really see a way to make it happen. But it occurred to me that with the spread of broadband, it's now possible to download even multi-hundred megabyte applications. The casual games market has demonstrated a business model that at least works in that area and could work for more hardcore games. But then the third thing that happened is I was asked by Eric Zimmerman to speak at the Game Developers Rant 2 years ago and essentially ranted about the basic problems I see in the industry. The drive for glitz over gameplay, the increasing conservatism of publishers as budgets increase, and so forth, and got a standing ovation from the audience. So that was the third piece of the equation, and it said to me that the developer community, at least, is ready for something like this as well. And so I left Nokia and announced on Manifesto Games with no funding, no deals in place, no technology, nothing. It's probably crazy, but that's what we did.
So how's it going?
Well, we launched the site about 3 months ago. We have achieved our initial revenues. Our the curve is heading in the right direction. We're still losing money, you know.
Wow.
So that's...
Early days.
Yes, exactly.
And this year at GDC, you are getting the Maverick Award.
Right.
How do you feel about that?
I'm both gratified and terrified. The Maverick Award previously has been given to the developers of Guitar Hero, the founders of PopCap, and Blast Theory, which is a British digital arts group which pretty much created the big urban game. So at least in two of these cases, we're talking about highly successful ventures. I'm a startup. So it kind of creates a set of expectations that, it's kind of scary to try to live up to those. On the other hand, again, it's an indication that the development community, at least, is very supportive of what we're trying to do, and that's a strong positive.
Yeah. Let me just ask you a few sort of general questions about just game design. When you design a game, do you start with the theme of the game, or do you start with a particular mechanic in mind that you're trying to explore, or is there...
I typically start with a theme. But I will say that there are lots of different approaches to this. Eric Zimmerman, for example, typically seems to start with a mechanic. And, Genova Chen seems to start with an emotion he wants to evoke. So, there are a lot of different ways to approach the problem.
Do you have any advice for someone who's inspiring to be a game designer? Well, I guess there's two parts to that.
Mm-hmm.
I guess there's the actually designing the game, and then there's the actually getting it done advice.
Well, okay, so firstly, I seem to encounter a lot of people who want to be game designers who don't play games. Which is insane. The idea that you would be a movie director without having watched thousands of movies, or a novelist without having read thousands of novels, is insane. So, the first thing is to play games. And don't just stick with a particular genre. Is play games of all sorts to see the kind of vast panoply of systems and approaches that are out there. The second thing I would suggest is that you design games. Even if it's just a little board game, or an adventure, or a mod, just anything, because there is no, you know, the best way to learn something is by doing it, even if you fail miserably. And if you're just doing something for yourself, if you're doing a little board game or a mod or something and you fail miserably, it's okay. You know, you'll still learn something from the experience. One of the advantages I had, which of course most people don't have, is, back in SBI days, they were churning out 4, 5, 6 games a month. Development cycles were 3 to 4 months typically. We got an opportunity to work on a lot of different games and therefore got a lot of experience experimenting and looking at different approaches. I think it's a lot harder with multi-year dev cycles for people to gain kind of equivalent experience in digital media today. But you can still short-circuit that or try to get some by doing stuff on your own.
Do you have any advice for someone who's trying to break into the game industry?
Go look at the IGDA website, where they have a strong section on that particular topic. The one other thing I will say is I would strongly advise people to stay away from game-specific university programs like DigiPen or Full Sail. The typical person in the games industry burns out after 5 years. And you will be much better off with a general CS degree or a general art degree if you want to transition to a different industry.
I did a color zero.
You say you haven't been following the war game industry at all. Have you been following the paper RPG industry at all?
A little bit.
Have you been tracking the independent RPGs?
Yes.
What do you think of that movement? I would guess you're in favor.
Absolutely. What more can you say? There's kind of a much higher level of innovation and attempts to do weird things with games in that area.
Are there any there that are catching your eyes?
It's been a while since I went out and bought some games, but Burning Wheel I was quite impressed with, and My Life with Master I was quite impressed with. So.
I noticed that you recently published your game Violence. Blah blah blah. I don't have the whole title written down.
Oh yeah.
Through Creative Commons. So.
Oh well, yeah. Well, okay. Years ago, I had lunch with James Wallace, who was then running Hogshead Publishers, and asked me if I was interested in doing another game. And I said, well, no, but I had this weird idea for a game that was kind of a satirical approach to role-playing in general and was hideously violent. And some years later, he launched the, New Line? New something? Line of very short role-playing games and asked if I would do that for him. And, I was kind of like, yeah, okay, I guess I can knock this out in a couple of weeks. It's like I'm not going to make any money, but it would be fun to do.
Right.
Hogshead went sort of out of business. Those games went out of print. I figured no one in his right mind would ever republish this thing again. I might as well put it up on my website under a Creative Commons license. So it's like, fine, so it's up there.
What do you think of publishing games through Creative Commons? General tactic, just for marketing?
For marketing, the whole point of Creative Commons is you're not going to make money off of it. So if you have something that you want to get out there, it's like, fine, great, and maybe Boing Boing will link to you, right?
Is there a game that you are most proud of?
Probably Paranoia.
So why Paranoia?
Because it's very focused. It really hits a tone. It was something people hadn't seen before, and I think it's a nicely polished game. So.
Shooting yourself in the foot and then examining the wound.
Anything else you'd like to add?
No, not really.
All right.
Okay.
Well, thank you for your time.
Oh, my pleasure.
Don't miss the first UK Games Expo. With 100 tournaments, 50 public participation games, 50 exhibitors, attractions include great board games including new releases, sneak peek at the new edition of Talisman, see new games from Warfog, JKLM, Surprise Stare, Ragnar Brothers, and many others, RPGs, card games, miniatures, computer games, and Imperial Stormtroopers in full kit, and many other attractions. A great weekend both for gaming enthusiasts and for the family. Go to the website www.ukgamesexpo.co.uk for full details on the event. UK Games Expo is the 2nd and 3rd of June in the Clarendon Suites in Edgbaston, Birmingham.
So, there's the interview. I hope you enjoyed it. I certainly did. Greg was also kind enough to give me a demo CD of some of the games on Manifesto. I strongly suggest you go check out the site. And maybe buy something. Let's keep that dream of independent games alive. Before I close, I do have a couple of pieces of feedback I'd like to go over this week. The first is a general audio comment from Jimmy Anderson.
Hi Jim, Jimmy Anderson here from Friendship, Tennessee, and you asked for comments on the comments that were made about your show. Specifically, Ken made a comment about how the show's format changing had caused his interest level to drop, and I will say that I agree, not to the point that I unsubscribed, but I will say that I didn't enjoy it as much. I agree with him in that I think the show is better as a monologue. No offense to Murr. I have listened to Pseudopod. I have listened to some of her podcasts that come through the Goblin Broadcasting Network. They tend to be a little different specific genre than what I usually listen to. But again, that's no reflection on her, and definitely no reflection on your podcast. But if I had to choose, I would say the one game, one show format is best. That's my personal feelings, and so that's my comment on that. If you're still interested, talk to you later.
Thanks for that comment, Jimmy. I do think that the show is getting more back on track, more fitting in what you'd like to see in the show. Hopefully people will enjoy the interviews, despite them being a little different from the usual one game, one show. But I will be getting back to that format soon. Maybe I'll cover Paranoia. I think I owe Greg Kostikian that. As a counterpoint to Jimmy's comments on Murr's presence, let me read from another listener, Tim Rogers. About earlier episodes. I really enjoyed the Empire Builder episode with Murr on it. I like your normal format because of the in-depth discussion and because of the nostalgia. But the Empire Builder episode is one of the few that really made me want to go out and play the game. And that was because the two of you sounded like you had fun playing it. The Acquire episode is another one that really caught my fancy. I actually bought a copy, although I haven't managed to play it yet. I'm glad we inspired you, Tim. And that's really the goal of the show, to inspire people to play those older games they've either missed or passed up. And whether it's with Murr or me alone, I'm happy with whatever works to get people out there playing those games. Tim also writes about the Tales of the Arabian Nights episode. I enjoyed your discussion of Tales of the Arabian Nights. I stumbled across a barely played copy of the West End edition earlier this year and really haven't had the time to explore it properly yet. After I found it, I was surprised by the game's desirability. The components are cheap. The counters are thin, the cards are printed on glossy paper rather than cardstock, and the board is rough-cut cardboard. I was glad to hear your take on the later edition. Based on that comment, Tim, I have to say I'm glad I have the later edition, despite the language barrier. And it actually sounds like, well, not to give too much away, but I did talk to Eric Goldberg, and he actually seems to prefer the later edition as well. And thanks for writing in, Tim. And this is probably a little egotistical of me, but I do have to read one more comment on the Tales of the Arabian Nights podcast. It goes as follows. Excellent episode. One of my favorite games, but some really interesting angles. Thanks a lot. That comment was from veteran reviewer Mike Siggins of Sumo Magazine. I was stunned to see that in my blog when it first came up. Getting a comment like that means so much. Thanks a lot to you, Mike. So that about wraps up the feedback for this week. If you have feedback on this show or the podcast in general, you can send that via email to vintagejim@gmail.com or Skype via username JVSquare. Or you can leave comments on the website, which is www.thevintagegamer.net. That one seems to be a particular favorite of most people. Or you can comment on the forum at BoardGameGeek, or RPG.net, or maybe even GPN.com, or wherever else I manage to post to. And thus concludes yet another inquisitive episode of The Vintage Gamer. Our theme is performed by the trio Music of the Spheres, and is available on the album of the same name at Magnatune.com. Your humble host is Jim Van Verth. The Vintage Gamer will return in a couple of weeks, actually maybe in a week, with another game from the past. Until then, keep trying those new games, but don't forget to play the old ones. Thanks for listening.